The Great Depression was perhaps the worst time for the United States of America in terms of hardship, short of the Civil War. And yet, do you know what led to the Great Depression? A trade war. The blockading, the cutting off, the embargoes, the simple cessation of trade with the United States and other countries, the freezing of Japanese assets in U.S. banks. This also eventually led to World War II. It culminated in a world war. The question is, are we seeing a bizarre repetition of history, and could the same thing happen again? What's been happening to the American economy? Why is our dollar weak? Why do we read in almost daily news releases that the dollar again is in trouble in Europe? And why do travelers abroad continually find themselves able to purchase fewer Deutschmarks, Swiss francs, French francs, or Japanese yen with their American dollars they take abroad than they could buy a year or two or three ago? What's causing it all? Dollar weak? Why is it weak? What is coin clipping? Why does our silver have a funny tinny ring to it, like the so-called European funny money of the 1950s, when now the American silver appears to be funny money? And people are hoarding bags of junk silver, coins not for numismatic value, but for the silver weight value today, because people know that something terrible is wrong with the American economy. Well, the sickness of the American dollar is directly related to the sickness of the American economy. And that gets right down to jobs, to prices, to spiraling inflation, and especially to world trade and our virtual inability to compete with the former vanquished enemies of World War II. You see, it seems to always happen that way. Nations that are down and out, as was the United States in the Depression of the 1930s, are nations that can easily be banded together by politicians with promises of bright future, by politicians with whatever despotic or personal goals, especially when you look at Europe and Germany in particular, in the wake of that massive worldwide depression that began in the United States but which rocked Europe to its very foundations. I want to talk about that in this program, but let's look at it from our point of view right now. We, when we were in the Great Depression, were willing to sacrifice on a collective basis. We saw all sorts of programs begun by the government. People were out of jobs by the millions. The suicide, the earlier traumatic shock of the bottom dropping out of the stock market. All of this gradually was replaced by an America that found itself in terms of the stolid determination of Yankee ingenuity of a new kind of a morality, not the new morality of today, but of values, social values, moral and religious values that were beginning to be found by our peoples in that day. Because for some reason, hungry people, desperate people, jobless people will turn to moral and religious sources for understanding in a time of deep national trauma. And so America began to forge its way ahead into a powerful young nation in the 1930s, in the late 30s. And it took the catalyst of World War II. In 1940, when Britain was deeply engaged and America was still holding back, and finally, Pearl Harbor and the massive then collective industrial capacity of the United States that began to grind out the material of warfare that resulted at the end of World War II, with the United States being the biggest single nation the world had ever seen, on top of the heap, as it were, with our enemies in Europe and over in Japan, prostrate, defeated, absolutely devastated, and having now unconditionally surrendered. But now where are we? We've come the full circle. These people who went all the way down began in much the same way as we did when we were all the way down. They began by self-sacrifice, by collective national effort, by the barest zero kind of a wage, nothing, maybe even a barter system, of where people were out with grubbing around in little vegetable patches, raising their own food. Front lawns disappeared in favor of carrot patches. And so these people gradually, with long, hard work weeks, 56, 65 more hours per week, with very low peripheral minimal wage areas where they were just barely able to keep together life and limb, began to produce commodities, products that were marketable in the United States and elsewhere. Gradually, over a period of time, the miracle of the European economic community, of the resurgence of Japan into a vital, powerful supergiant of our modern space age era has occurred. Now these peoples are too having their own problems of unionism and of inflation and of joblessness, and problems beginning to occur, as they always do, when affluence is gained. But unfortunately, the United States is well ahead of them. And we are now at the very crisis, a very turning point in our history, where economists are beginning to warn that it isn't impossible, no matter what we think in rich, comfortable, overfed America, that a new stock market crash could occur, that the bottom could drop out of the United States economy, and that we could enter another Great Depression. And if we do, Europe cannot escape, Japan cannot escape. Trade war is the first warning sign that some kind of a Great Depression is ahead. And I believe the opening shots of trade war have already been fired. And I want to warn you that any threat to the way of life that is enjoyed by the West German people, the people in Europe, the Japanese people today, any threat toward their standard of living, which is at an all-time high in their entire history, could lead toward the diversion of various important monies or funds in a very unsavory political quarters. I think we all know what happened after the Great Depression. The jobless people tend to blame the government in charge, and at sometimes irresponsible governments result in despotic governments, which result in warlike postures. And I'll go through that here in a moment. We may be seeing a repetition of that same thing. And we need to be warned. We need to be informed about it. Today, the dollar is becoming an unwanted currency around the world. It lacks strength and confidence in other countries. One German banker, as a matter of fact, in Frankfurt, distraught with the fact that nobody wants American dollars, said, and I quote, "Germany must do something. It cannot absorb any more dollars without creating disastrous inflation in this country." What happens is that speculators present their dollars to a German bank for marks. In order to buy those dollars, the German bank has to create marks out of thin air, as it were. More extra marks circulate around Germany, and that forces prices up. European financial leaders say it is a fact that there is no faith in the dollar. You see, a great deal more money has flowed out of the United States in the last several years, 7 out of 10, than has come in, largely because of the combined force of two things: our military spending in foreign areas and tourism. In that period of 7 to 10 years, America's international deficits have totaled over $56 billion. Much of it has gone to Europe and left Europeans with a feeling that they are a swim in a sea of worthless money, paper money that is not backed up by gold, which of course has led many European leaders, and De Gaulle was a leader in this in times past, to insist that the United States money, or the dollar, be removed from the status of a reserve currency and that currencies be pinned to a gold standard instead. Since 1971, the United States has been buying more foreign goods than it's been sold, and I should say that it has sold. In other words, this is the imports-exports imbalance we talked about in the past three programs. The first time since 1890 that this has occurred. Last year, the margin of imports over exports was a devastating $6.4 billion. To a European, a United States dollar is virtually worthless unless he can buy American goods with it. And if America doesn't export enough goods for him to buy, then his dollar is virtually worthless. It isn't only the Americans, then, that ought to be concerned about the weakened state of the dollar. It is also people inside the European economic community and people in Japan who are seriously concerned about the weakness of the dollar, and they didn't make the dollar weak. We did.
A new economic power block with a population of 300 million people is rapidly shaping up in Europe. With treaties signed already, the European Economic Community has trade ties with 93 nations, with a corner on 43% of world export trade. Europe is fast becoming the supermarket of the free world. Future developments in Europe will cause us to forget Vietnam's agonizing curse on American society. How will they affect you, your family, job, and future? Stay informed and stay ahead of world developments through the pages of The Plain Truth magazine. Full color, 52 pages, with monthly articles on Europe and other issues vital to you. Be sure to request The Plain Truth, the world's unique human interest news magazine. Your free subscription will begin immediately if you write Ambassador College, Box 111, Pasadena, California. In Canada, Box 44, Vancouver, BC.
Talk to the average man on the street and they say that the Europeans owe us something, that they're not giving us a fair deal, that we have built them up from nothing and they owe us everything. They've literally said this in our interviews that we've conducted in preparation for these programs. They've said that we picked them up out of nothing, they were our former enemies, we built them back up, gave them all this money, we feel now it's time for them to give something to us. They don't see it that way. They see it from an entirely different perspective. They see that it was their sacrifice, their hardship. And of course, people always look at it selfishly, you might say. So do we, so do they. But nevertheless, they see it, I think, a little more realistically than we do. The Europeans themselves were the ones who were lying there amidst the rubble of 1945 and 46. They were the ones that suffered that terrible winter in 1946 when many thousands died. They were the ones working those endless long hours, the ones going to work at 5:15, 5:30 in the morning with a whistle and a lunch pail filled with something other than a really square meal. They were the ones who built back up from virtually nothing, and the United States aided them in technical help, in Marshall Plan dollars, in foreign aid. That's for sure. But you know, the United States has never been able to buy friends abroad, no matter how many voices have been lifted up to government to try to tell government, don't do it, you can't buy friends. We've spent billions in India, a nation which has rarely, if ever, supported United States policies in the UN or elsewhere in the community of nations on the face of the earth. And the same thing is true in Europe. With all the money that we have sent over there, we have not bought friends of Europeans. That isn't the way you obtain friends. Over the years, we have given away 150 billions of our dollars in foreign aid. Last year, the United States spent $4 billion on its armed forces defending Europe. And until 2 years ago, the United States has paid for up to 80% of Japan's defense. All of this money the United States has sent abroad has helped produce a glut of $90 billion floating around Europe. And maybe floating is an apt term. That $90 billion is used by currency speculators to buy other currencies. That causes the value of such currencies, like that of the Swiss franc and the German mark, to soar. That in turn destroys the tedious plans of European leaders trying to create one European currency. It's a kind of a legalized counterfeiting. But there is only $11 billion in gold backing up those dollars, making them in effect worthless in terms of gold. For many Europeans who have seen devaluations destroy the buying power of their own money, this represents a special threat to their prosperity. Because they distrust Uncle Sam's dollar, Europeans are buying gold in record amounts. The price of gold has tripled in less than 2 years. In the United States, many old areas abandoned from gold mining simply because the cost of the dollars per ton of ore was not equal to the dollars per ton they could get out of that ore have now been reopened. There is new speculation, new prospecting, because the price of gold has gone so high that once again it is making it worthwhile for investors to begin to open up some formerly old closed mines. Many Europeans resent American companies investing and buying European companies on the continent. The Servan Schreiber book, American Challenge, or The Challenge from Abroad, which was responded to by Franz Josef Strauss, the head of the CDU-CSU, CSU actually part of the coalition in Bavaria, who wrote a book, Challenge and Response, that is, the response of the European economic community to the American challenge of buying up industries inside Europe. The sight of Americans owning so many industries, with American money obviously behind it, American profits flowing out from it, irritates many Germans, French, British, Dutch, Belgians, Italians, and what have you. Trade issues between America and Europe run deep these days. There have been a lot of screaming sessions that you haven't heard very much about. Friction is there, and they are a potential cause for a complete disintegration of the Atlantic Alliance. American farmers resent the barriers the common market has erected to their produce. For example, Europeans have a tax on American wheat that automatically forces up its price to the point where it's equal with European wheat. Both sides of the Atlantic protest each other's laws, inspection systems or quotas, and trade laws, which combine to hurt confidence in partners who should be respecting one another. But what about trade war? Trade war is in the offing, and I have warned on this for years on this program, on radio as well as television, and the opening shots have already been fired, because the minute you have protectionist measures, and if there's any one thing that we have seen in recent years in Congress, it has been the tendency toward protectionist measures or an almost trade isolationism on our part in order to keep our inflated standard of living going, our high prices, our high wages, and so on, all out of proportion to Europe. And at the same time, force these other companies and countries from abroad to send less goods and to make those goods of the same price so that Americans will tend to buy American just by comparing the prices instead of almost automatically reaching for the high quality but cheaper priced commodity from abroad. What about trade war, though? We've already seen there are big problems which are tearing America and Europe apart, problems which remain unsolved. The lack of confidence in the dollar, the trade barriers, the wild gyrations in currency values, and the mutual resentment that both sides are building up threaten to lead the major Western nations to take drastic trade-restricting measures, stopping the flow of foreign goods into American ports. If that happens, we will have a trade war on our hands. When nations put up legal restrictions to that massive flow of goods from one country to another, that is a trade war. A trade war occurs when a nation starts refusing to accept the goods of another, or places tremendous restrictions on them, terrible surcharges, which we have done, taxes, quotas. This is finally followed by complete cutoff of trade and embargoes, like a trade blockade. That provokes the nation whose trade is cut off to do something to retaliate. And so that nation does so, such as keeping American tourists out, making life untenable or impossible, maybe nationalization of industries inside that country where great investments exist, whatever, some retaliation. Soon, trade completely is cut off, then commerce, then all diplomatic relations, and you have a warlike posture. Now, as I said in the beginning, the Great Depression was really what started World War II, because it led to a Great Depression in Germany. That led to a complete change of the subventions from major industries into political quarters that were less savory than we would have liked. Adolf Hitler came riding up to a crest of power on the slogans about, kind of like ours, you know, a chicken in every pot and a Volkswagen in every garage. That was the people's car that Hitler promised. I don't know if you Americans know that, do you? Volkswagen was a part of Hitler's speeches. They were going to have a people's car for everybody. It was the dream of way back when. And today, I would like to comment again, as I believe Lord Beaverbrook's Daily Express in London did one time rather acidly. It appears, he said to British people, the Volkswagen is about to do to us what Hitler's submarines failed to do in World War II.
The mighty Roman Empire had everything. Plenty of leisure time. Their own new morality. Enormous military might. The religion of their choice. Political freedom. What went wrong? Read The Modern Romans, a 93-page lesson of history ignored. For your free copy of The Modern Romans, write Ambassador College, Box 111, Pasadena, California. In Canada, Box 44, Vancouver, B.C. The Modern Romans asks, can we afford the grandeur of Rome?
Will the wind someday blow mournfully around the ruins of New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles? Will the United States someday revert to an agrarian society? Will we go through an unbelievable cycle of greatness down to abject poverty? What happens if a trade war does strike? What would happen to the United States if world trade suddenly dried up where we're concerned, and we were cut off from the flow of goods from the common market, from all of the countries, Central and South America, and from Asia, and of course from Japan? Our vaunted standard of living would disintegrate overnight, for one thing, and we would suddenly plummet into the grips of massive depression. Why? or because we depend upon imports for our standard of living. 95% of our transistor radios, 40% of our shoes, 45% of nails and staples, 37% of textiles machinery, 58% of our sweaters, 42% of our woven dress and sports shirts, 96% of the motorcycles, and 30% of our bicycles, and 75% of our tennis rackets are imported. Every sixth car is imported in the United States of America, and today we're having to import up to about 20% of our fuel, or our fossil fuels, that's in terms of oil. If a trade war occurred, prices in these items and lots of others, too numerous to mention, would go right out the top, so that a person simply couldn't afford to buy them, and of course, very quickly, they would become non-existent and simply unavailable. 70% of our fish supply is imported. So many of these goods couldn't even be produced in the United States, and if there were, you couldn't afford to buy them. It takes many workers to produce them, and American wages are all out of line with foreign workers anyhow. It's too high then to make it economically feasible. 4 million American jobs are directly related to exports and imports. That includes jobs such as aircraft workers, Volkswagen mechanics, foreign car dealers, clothing salesmen, retail clerks, and farm workers. If a trade war cut off these jobs, unemployment in the United States would soar to 11% and probably go higher as the loss of buying power would make itself felt around the country. Donald Platton, who was chairman of Chemical Bank, said, and I quote, "There is the possibility of a complete loss of confidence and a global slump that eventually would make the Great Depression of the 1930s seem like a summer picnic." What is he, an alarmist? He, many other bankers and economists have been trying to warn our American people that we seem to be headed along the very same lines that were being drawn up in 1927 and 28 and 29. But when you go back, you ask yourself, has a nation ever listened to a warning? Ancient Rome had lots of people that were standing around in street corners, as it were, extemporizing about the horrible problems that existed. Massive entertainment, giant military spending, overseas garrisoning that dwindled the power of the nation, massive foreign aid, a public that was glutted with nothing but the good life and divorce that was rampant, the home breaking up, entertainment, and I include in that Christians being thrown to lions and so on. And they could have warned them, and as a matter of fact, there are the writings which still exist today which tend to indicate there was a strong voice of alarm and warning lifted up prior to the collapse and the disintegration of the Roman Empire. Will America listen to a warning today? I doubt it. I sincerely doubt it. I believe the die is cast. I'm not saying that America could not repent individually and collectively of our national sins, immoralities, and all of our greed, which basically is at the very heart and the core of our economic difficulties. I'm not saying that we can't repent, that we couldn't change our minds and our hearts, that we couldn't recapture a real spirit of the kind of patriotism which is the right kind, which is not just chauvinistic or racial in nature. But I'm saying I doubt if we will. And you can go back to the time during the McNamara offense, for example, clear back in terrible defense spending days during Vietnam. We were going to see the closure of a lot of military bases. And this, to me, is illustrative of some of our problems. Everybody could hail this. They said, oh, great, we want to cut down in defense spending. We want to cut down on this giant military machine because so almost the entire revenue the government experienced from the Internal Revenue Service of the withholding tax was going for defense spending alone. And we knew this, so we hailed the idea that government was now going to retreat a little bit from its terrible defense spending. When it came time to close up some of those bases, here's what you had. You'd have a big Air Force base, and around that Air Force base would be satellite industries. Living on it in the local community would be thousands of people, civil service workers, the military people themselves. Now, living from the income from all these people would be florists and chemists and druggists and all the way from the haberdasher to the undertaker. And when you close down a giant military base, nearby towns and communities get their entire livelihood from these bases. So giant screams of alarm were raised. And even though, well, it's good for the nation as a whole, everybody would say, but go close down somebody else's military base. Don't close down mine. Does that tell you anything? When I listened to the governor's conference on California's changing environment, I saw yet another aspect of human nature as it played in some of these problems which seem to be virtually insoluble. More, screams our massive millions of people. More of all the goods and the services and the flow of those goods and services that give us the good life. We want more energy slaves, but we don't want to hear about an energy crisis. More electricity, more power, more gas. What do you mean a fuel shortage? Don't try to tell me that. The big companies are lying to us, says the Archie Bunker types, who won't listen to any kind of a warning at all, no matter how accurately and thoroughly discussed in the press and the media it might be. So the president of Southern California Edison stood up and told the people there that we may be facing some massive power failures in the future. Why? Well, because he said we can't build the plants to produce the power fast enough. We have the environmentalists and the ecologists screaming about the black stacks, about the soot and the smoke, about the burning of non-renewable fossil fuels. And he said this slogan I've never forgotten. He said, "Be it ever so humble, there is no place." And then he went on to say how though the populace is increasing faster than any other part of the country, of Southern California, by their very presence here, demand more power, more electricity. When the electrical companies come along to build that power plant, which means these big steam facilities with giant belching smokestacks to produce the wattage of power needed, he said, be it ever so humble, there is no place. The people along the coastline say, build the stupid thing out in the high desert. And the people in the desert say, don't build it here. The people in Fontana say, build it over in San Bernardino. And the people in San Bernardino say, build it over in Duarte or El Monte or down in Long Beach. And the people there say, take your dumb plant and put it up near San Francisco. Be it ever so humble, there is no place. We, like spoiled children, want our grandiose, fantastic, high, if that's what it is, standard of living. But are we willing to make the sacrifices necessary to preserve it? I say, as you look around America, the signs are not good that we are. So it may come to pass someday that we will make those sacrifices, whether we want to or not, that we will be forced back to a posture of national collective sacrifice that day when the bottom drops out of our economy. I tell you, it's likely that it could happen here. You ought to write for this booklet called The Modern Romans and see if there is any connection between what happened then and what is happening right now. Until next time, Garner Ted Armstrong. Goodbye, friends.
You have seen Garner Ted Armstrong. Send your letters to Ambassador College, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. Or Post Office Box 44, Vancouver, BC.